Again, so glad that you're here with us this morning. I have the honor of speaking with you again today, and we're going to move on from last week. Last week, we looked at how God's calling for our lives is specific to us. He's given us attributes. He's given us characteristics that help us fulfill a mission that is specific to each one of us. What does he want to do with our lives? Remember that it truly has nothing to do with what we want to accomplish or attain. God's calling, the kind only he is able to decide, always works towards accomplishing his mission alone. We also took a peek at what it meant to offer ourselves as a living sacrifice to God and be used by him however he should choose. We looked at Romans 12, 1 and 2 that says, "Therefore I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will." As we enter week 5 of this series, we're going to open up the strategy guide and learn how to be used and to play the game with greatness and grace. I don't know if you know this about me, but I'm a fairly competitive guy. Yeah, I know. I hide it really well. I find great joy in competition. Sports, debates, choosing what's on TV, timing myself while I mow the lawn, falling asleep before Riley does. I have an incessant competitive fire burning within me. Believe it or not, I've actually cranked down the intensity of my constant competitiveness over the last 2 years. I don't think it's a coincidence that my 2-year anniversary is tomorrow. Nevertheless, I find competition absolutely thrilling. We can all feel thrill when we see competitive greatness in action. Think about it. Think about the most competitive greatness that you've ever seen. Certain things come into my mind, because again, I'm a sports guy, so the 1980 Olympic hockey team. No, I wasn't around to witness it, but seeing it in that movie with Herb Russell, yeah? Oh, amazing, right? Michael Phelps, watching that guy just destroy every swimmer on the planet for years, Olympics after Olympics after Olympics. It's thrilling. It's absolutely amazing to watch. And yes, I'll admit it, the 2016 Cubs, they were pretty fun to watch. They were great and they were thrilling because of how good they were, the level of greatness that they had attained. There's something about drive, the competitive quest for greatness, about the search for mastery and striving for excellence that moves deep within us. The real contest is to see if we can compete, offer our best, and not give up in the face of great demand. Running is one of the greatest and most difficult sports that there is. It perfectly encapsulates that statement that I just read. Each and every time a runner goes out for a training run or competes in a race, a runner's goal is always to give their best and not give up in the face of the heat, the cold, the rain, the blisters, the aches and pains, not to mention the mental war that's raging in their minds. Competitive greatness arises from a love for battle, a resolve that welcomes the opportunity to do our best when our best is required of us. This is why the competitive drive of a runner to win a race was one of the Apostle Paul's favorite images of the life of faith. At Green Lake this year, our theme was the amazing race. There were team competitions, and each day that would tie into our teacher's message for the day. Each of the teaches revolved around 1 Corinthians 9, 24 to 27. Here, Paul presents a powerful picture of the fire of competitive greatness. It reads, "Don't you realize that in a race, everyone runs, but only one person gets the prize? So run to win. All athletes are disciplined in their training. They do it to win a prize that will fade away. But we do it for an eternal prize. So I run with purpose in every step. I'm not just shadow boxing. I discipline my body like an athlete, training it to do what it should. Otherwise, I fear that after preaching to others, I myself might be disqualified. Again, Paul tells us that everyone runs. In this way, you certainly do not have to be a runner in order to be running a race. There are all kinds of different races in life to choose from. They go in all different directions and will bring you all different things along the way. We must choose the race that we want to run. Should we choose God's race, we must be willing to compete at the absolute highest level. Luckily for us, we have the manual on how to compete well. Philippians 3:13-14 says, "No, dear brothers and sisters, I have not achieved it, but I focus on this one thing, forgetting the past and looking forward to what lies ahead. I press on to reach the end of the race and receive the heavenly prize for which God, through Christ Jesus, is calling us." So again, Paul's saying we've got to be there. We've got to get, it doesn't end until our time here on earth is over. We need to keep pressing and getting better and better and growing deeper and deeper in our relationship with God. We follow that up with Hebrews 12:1-3. "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a huge crowd of witnesses to the life of faith, let us strip off every weight that slows us down, especially the sin that so easily trips us up. Let us run with endurance the race God has set before us." We do this by keeping our eyes on Jesus, the champion who initiates and perfects our faith. Because of the joy awaiting him, he endured the cross, disregarding its shame. Now he's seated in the place of honor beside God's throne. Think of all the hostility he endured from sinful people. Then you won't become weary and give up. Maybe thinking, yeah, this race sounds pretty grueling. Why in the world would I sign up? In Paul's second letter to Timothy, we see in chapter 4, "I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race, and I have remained faithful. And now the prize awaits me, the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on the day of his return. And the prize is not just for me, but for all who eagerly look forward to his appearing." See, Paul was a fighter. He endured trial after trial and never once doubted God. He always kept going for more. He always kept pushing to be better. We need to ask ourselves if we're willing to do the same thing. We need to look at ourselves in the mirror and seriously ask, am I a quitter or am I a competitor? You see, every runner comes up against those days where they just have no interest in going out and pounding that pavement. Even our stud Southfield cross-country runners like Vivian, Seth, Jordan, and Vincent have had days where they thought of running as a completely unappealing option for one reason or another. So they need to make a choice. Are they quitters or are they competitors? Speaking to my own experience, when I was a junior in high school, I was an up-and-coming runner. I joined the cross-country team as a sophomore, and I made varsity at the very end of sophomore year. So again, I was feeling pretty good about myself. Coming into junior year, there was a solid group of seniors that I was good friends with, and we were dialed up to make state for the first, because we just missed it my sophomore year. So we're due to make state for the first time since 1977. There was a lot of hype going into this year. And I'm not going to lie to you, my mom will tell you, at the beginning of every summer, when it came time for summer running, I quit cross country. I was like, no, I'm not doing this again. I'm not putting myself through that. I'm playing baseball all summer. Forget this running thing. I'm done. And she'd be like, no, you can't do that. You have to keep going. But I'd quit, and then 2 weeks into summer running, I'd be like, all right, I'll go out and do it. So I'd go out and I'd train, but I never put in the max effort. Like, I'm going to get to that part in a minute, but I never put in max effort, especially during the summer, because I'd run all these miles in the morning, and then I'd have like double headers in the afternoon. So my summers were just jam-packed with exhausting sports, which was a lot of fun. But again, in terms of my cross-country ability, I could have been a lot better. Now, when we got into season, I expected to be back in my number 5 slot on the cross country team, scoring for our team as one of the top 7, and doing pretty well. However, I chose to follow some seniors whose leadership was a little skewed. You see, a lot of these runners were just there to hang out. They were there because they had basketball coming or they had wrestling coming, and they just wanted to stay kind of in shape while being a part of a team. So there were a few times that we would leave the school on a timed run. So we'd have to go out for 45 minutes or 50 minutes for a run, and I'd be with the varsity guys to start. But then I found out that some of our flying squirrels, which was our JV guys, they would split off and go have cookouts at one of our friends' houses. So they'd go into the backyard, dead serious. They'd have hot dogs. We'd have chips. We'd have on trampoline. We'd be throwing bags. And we'd have a great time. Then with about 10 minutes before we had to be back, we'd splash water on ourselves, run back to the school, and make it look like we just had endured that grueling 50-minute run. Well, we never did get caught doing that, but it definitely showed in my performance. See, Coach Kevin Gummerson, for those who know him, is a pretty strict guy. He wants his team to be in tip-top shape, and he always carries a pencil behind his ear. Sometimes he carries 2. Reason, because he throws them. When he gets mad, he'll take that pencil and he will spike it in the ground. You do not want to be the reason for Coach Gummerson spiking his pencil in the ground. And I'll tell you, my junior year, my attitude was completely out of whack. My drive wasn't there, and I was the reason for a lot of pencil throwing. He actually moved me down to junior varsity, and I thought that was just, I came home and said, he just doesn't like me anymore. I don't get it. And my mom was like, well, you didn't really run during the summer, and your time is slower than last year, so what do you expect? I had to make a decision. Was I going to get back into the swing of things, work hard, and get back into varsity? Or was I going to quit? Was I going to be a quitter or a competitor? Luckily, I did bring back the competitive edge in me, but I wanted my natural ability to be enough. Back then, I didn't want to work at it. And to this day, it's one of my greatest regrets. The biggest regret anyone could ever have, though, is choosing to quit God's race. The sin that separates us from God will try to distract us and pull us away, like the thoughts that run through a runner's head as they're going. I'm tired. I'm weak. I'm hurt. I'm sick. I'm hot. I'm cold. I'm upset. I'm busy. Matthew 7:13 says, you can enter God's kingdom only through the narrow gate. The highway to hell is broad, and its gate is wide for the many that choose that way. It's important for us to identify the things that hinder us from running a strong spiritual race, as well as the things that encourage us to continue strong in our faith. Dieting is another perfect metaphor in this instance. In order to successfully begin a diet, you need to get the junk food out of the house. It's not necessarily an easy thing to do, especially here in America where we're full of junk food and, well, it's delicious. Why would I get rid of it? To give you an idea of what this looks like when we cling to our sinful habits, I have a little video clip for you.
I need you guys to help me in the kitchen to fill these.
We can do it.
I don't like this crap.
Definitely no cheese in the can. Oh. Very happy to be throwing this away.
It's bacon.
I gotta tell you something. Bacon is good for me. This is very
good.
You're
gonna be going to the grocery store.
She thinks at the blue she's a smart little girl that she can do whatever she wants. No, that's not how she can do it in our family. She's act like she's the queen and we're the sorry people. Joy, I have been nice to you, but now I'm coming to the edge.
I promise you one thing, okay? If you do not have at least one food that you like, I will buy you a piece of junk. Is that a deal?
No, I keep losing at deals, and I don't want to make a deal anymore. I am leaving, and you can't stop me. I'm packing my bags. And a very, very calm day until this. A bump in the road comes, and she beats sarcastic.
Curtis.
I won't be coming back until Saturday when you leave. she's gonna try to stop me, but she can't run those little high heels. Never see this face again.
That video is both hilarious and painfully sad all at the same time. We really do act like this petulant kid a lot in the eyes of God. We need to be the opposite of that. We must admit the things that'll cause us to stumble so that we can be on the attack, ready to fight those things that demotivate us and lead us to quit and take easier paths, kind of like junk food in a diet. I've used the word we quite a bit here, and that's not by mistake. Winning is something that we do together. Winning and staying gracious is one of the great tests of character, because now I have to remember that winning isn't all about me. A few years back, there was a kid by the name of Jake Porter who went to Northwest High School in McDermott, Ohio. He had a disorder called chromosomal fragile X, making him cognitively challenged, but the kid loved football. The last game of his senior year, Jake got to suit up with the team. His coach, Dave France, went to the opposing coach and requested that if the game were to get out of hand either way, he'd like to get Jake in the game just for one play. See, they practiced snapping it to him and letting him take a knee all week long. So he told the coach, if this game gets out of hand, that's our plan. They practiced and practiced, and finally, game day comes. With 5 seconds left in the game, Northwest was down 42-0. So Coach France calls a timeout, and he goes to put Jake in. The opposing coach, who knew what was about to happen, came sprinting across the field. So Coach France is like, wait a second, did he change his mind? Like, what's going to happen here? Are we still cool? And he grabbed him by the shirt, and he said, you give that kid the ball, and he's going to score. So we have an opposing coach in a high school football game saying, you know what? I see the value in getting this kid a score. So again, 5 seconds left. The quarterback takes the snap. He hands it to Jake. And they had told Jake, like, we're not kneeing it this time. You're going to take off for that end zone. But they handed him the ball, and he about took a knee. He got within like 3 or 4 inches of the ground before the quarterback grabbed him, pulled him up, and said, no, Jake, go, and pushed him. So Jake kind of did a little dive and dash, and then his whole team pushed with him, running, pointing for the end zone. The defense came with him, running, pointing for the end zone, clapping, cheering, crying. He scored. And they all celebrated with him. And those guys grow up. They won't remember their stats. They won't remember the details of that game at all. But none of them will forget Jake Porter's touchdown. His touchdown became everybody's touchdown. Just like that, we must support each other in our callings. Don't hesitate to show love, give support, and be there for each other, because the game that we play is not a single-player game. We must also play the game with gratitude. See, gratitude is the ability to experience life as a gift. It's how those who are rich toward God, rich in being, not just having, play the game. Lou Gehrig is undisputedly one of the greatest baseball players of all time. He amassed 493 homers, 1,995 RBIs, and had a career 340 batting average. That's insanely good. If you don't know baseball, that's like, again, all-time great. His nickname was the Iron Horse because he played in 2,130 consecutive games. Nowadays, guys can't get through the week without having the sniffles and calling a day off. From June 1st, 1925 to April 30th, 1939, Lou Gehrig played in every single game. It's 14 straight seasons. There are only 14 players alive today, or active today, who have even had that many games played, let alone played consecutively. But then on July 4th, 1939, he had to give a speech that is pictured here. He said, fans, for the past 2 weeks, you've been reading about the bad break I got. See, Lou Gehrig had contracted ALS. And now ALS is commonly known as Lou Gehrig's disease because of this speech. For the past 2 weeks, you've been reading about the bad break I got. Yet today I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of this earth. I've been in ballparks for 17 years and have never received anything but kindness and encouragement from you fans. Sure, I'm lucky. When the New York Giants, a team that you would give your right arm to beat and vice versa, sends you a gift, that's something. When everybody down to the groundskeepers and those boys in the white coats remember you with the trophies, that's something. When you have a wonderful mother-in-law who takes sides with you in squabbles with her own daughter, that's something. When you have a father and a mother who work all their lives so that you can have an education and build your body, it's a blessing. When you have a wife who's been a tower of strength and has shown more courage than you dreamed existed in the world, that's the finest thing I know. So I close in saying that I may have had a tough break, but I still have an awful lot to live for. All of the things that he had earned throughout his baseball career, all the accolades, the records, he knew that that wasn't who he was. That's not who Lou Gehrig was. He was so much more than that. And the people around him meant so much to him. You see, Lou got it. He understood. And think about that irony for a second. ALS is a neurological disease that effectively shuts down messages from the brain to the body, and then your muscles start to decay. They literally start to melt away. Biblically speaking, we see what it means to live with gratitude in the story of the grateful leper found in Luke chapter 17. Here it says, as Jesus continued on toward Jerusalem, he reached the border between Galilee and Samaria. As he entered a village there, 10 men with leprosy stood at a distance, crying out, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. See, if you had leprosy back in those days, you literally had to walk around proclaiming unclean, unclean, to let everybody know that you had this contagious disease. Jesus looked at them and said, go show yourselves to the priests. And as they went, they were cleansed of their leprosy. One of them, when he saw that he was healed, came back to Jesus shouting, praise God! He fell to the ground at Jesus' feet, thanking him for what he had done. This man was a Samaritan. Jesus asked, didn't I heal 10 men? Where are the other 9? Has no one returned to give glory to God except this foreigner? Jesus then said to the man, stand up and go. Your faith has healed you. See, gratitude is not something that we give to God because he wants to make sure we know how much trouble he went to over us. As one author writes, gratitude is the gift that God gives us that enables us to be blessed by all his other gifts, the way our taste buds enable us to enjoy the gift of food. Without gratitude, our lives degenerate into envy, dissatisfaction, and complaints, taking what we have for granted and always wanting more. The illusion of gratitude is that we will experience more of it if we get the stuff that we want. I hear more and more adults talking about how the current generation of kids up through junior high school age, they're overly self-centered and ungrateful, and how dare they this, how dare they that. The problem with comments like that are that this generation of kids, they've been given everything that they want. They have never been told no. You can't expect a child to be grateful when their needs and wants are completely fulfilled at their beck and call. Refusing to say no to a child will surely dull their sense of gratitude, just as refusing to exhibit self-control in our own lives will dull our own sense of gratitude. Sometimes God says no, and it's to grow us. Finally, we are to play the game with grace. The number one rule, if you want to win the game, to compete, is to be the kind of person that other people want to sit next to and the kind of player that others don't mind losing to. The Bible's word for that is grace. We have to learn how to live, how to play the game with grace. It was my grandpa's birthday on Friday. Actually, both of my grandpas. Both my grandpas have the same birthday. And weird thing, Riley's grandpas, they both have the same birthday too. Kind of weird. But I actually got to see a lot of my grandpa Fry in his last year of life. He passed away this past fall. And he dealt with sickness and pain constantly throughout the last little while. But you know what? That didn't stop him from using every last ounce of energy, all of his time, all of his effort to be in the service of others. He would constantly be singing hymns, sharing the gospel with his doctors who had heard it time and again. The guy, until his final breath, was praising God and sharing that with the world. Don't be the kind of person who has something small happen and focus on the negative. Realize the bigger plan. See what God can do with your life and strive for greatness with grace. We are to win with grace, lose with grace, and forgive with grace. I'm going to pray here at the end, and I'm actually going to be reading Psalm 119, 25 to 35 from the Message. Because I think praying verses, especially the Psalms, like that, it's really powerful to do sometimes. So let's close in prayer. I'm feeling terrible. I couldn't feel worse. God, get me on my feet again. You promised, remember? When I told my story, you responded. Train me well in your deep wisdom. Help me understand these things inside and out so I can ponder your miracle wonders. My sad life is dilapidated, a falling down barn. Build me up again by your word. Barricade the road that goes nowhere. Grace me with your clear revelation. I choose the true road to somewhere. I post your road signs at every curve and corner. I grasp and cling to whatever you tell me. God, don't let me down. I'll run the course you lay out for me if you just show me how. God, teach me lessons for living so I can stay the course. Give me insight so I can do what you tell me. My whole life one long, obedient response. Guide me down the road of your commandments, for I love traveling this freeway. Amen.
Normally when I show up at church, I know what the sermon is going to be. And so it is an unusual experience to walk into church, have no idea of what's going to be said, and to realize that all week long, the Spirit of God has been speaking that message to me prior to walking in the door. It's just crazy. I don't know why, between YouVersion and just some of the verses of the week and things like that, over and over again this week, I've had this thought of the spiritual race is a race that we have to run to win. It's a fight. Paul repeatedly says, it's a fight. And you need to fight. You need to battle through. And for far too many of us, you know, we want cupcake Christianity, right? We want it to be easy. We want it to be smooth. We don't want to battle. We don't want to battle against the sin that's within us. We don't want to fight. We don't want to struggle. We just want to kind of white flag it and say, wait a second, wasn't Christianity supposed to make my life easier and better? But it's a fight. It's a struggle. It's a race. It's a battle. We press on. We press on. So thank you so much for that message today, Brett. My name is Dennis. Some of you have never met me before. Others of you wonder where I went. And the way this works, just so that you know, I know sometimes when I'm gone for a little stretch, some of you are like, oh no, he's out looking for a job or something. I go away so I can stay. That's what this is about. I get some time away so that I can find my legs again and so that I can be renewed in my spirit. I can be honest, I've been off for about 3 weeks, and it's only this past week that I finally started to relax. It was only this past week that Sunday came, and I wasn't laying in bed going, it's time. So it's important. I think it's important for all of us to have some time every day that we divert. We've got to divert daily. Weekly, we need to walk away. That's what Sabbath is all about, walking away from work. And you need to abandon annually. And looking around the room, some of our friends have abandoned. The Beakers are, they're off on a cruise, and you got people running all over the place. I've watched all the Facebook fun of beautiful places all across America that people are traveling. But we need those times of rest, and I hope that you've gotten yours, because the end of July is here, and in the modern era, school starts in about 3 days. So I hope you got your rest. Our servers are going to come right now and receive the offering, and I'm going to share a number of things with you today. During July, we did something that we thought was really important. We had our Southfield kids in the room with us, and we do that quite intentionally as a formative tool. We think it's important. We think it's vital for our children to experience what we do on a Sunday morning. We very much believe in kids learning on their own level. And at the same time, we have a strong belief that sometimes it's important to come in and sit with mom, sit with dad, see what happens in here. What's this communion thing all about, and singing and all. We don't want it to be that our kids get into ninth grade and for the first time they're sitting in a church service. We think it's really important part of their formation. I gotta tell you honestly, you know, we did not have children's church at my church growing up. We sat in church. And at 7 years old, I was listening to what was going on in church, and God was calling my heart toward what I do today. So I don't think that we can all at all undervalue or underestimate what we've done here this summer. I think the other thing it does that is really important is it gives the people who literally 12 months a year are teaching our kids a chance to allow their hearts and souls to go quiet as well. So they come off just this raucous week of day camp, and then they come to July, and they're able to step back for a moment, because those that teach, those that lead, need a chance sometimes to shut their mouths and listen. That's true for all of us. So one of the things you see on your folder today is if there's a story that you'd like to share about having your kids in the service, we'd love to hear it. We actually give you the church email address there, office@southfieldchurch.com. And I've actually seen a couple stories on Facebook, which have been kind of fun, of people commenting about things that kids have learned from what was said or whatever. So if there's something that you know has been formative for your own child or for you, maybe it's just been that experience of sitting together. I know, you know, Kim was saying not too long ago that some of her strongest memories are sitting in church holding her dad's hand, just holding that hand. So we don't know what is going to impact a person along the way, but those impact points are so important. So having said that, next week, they're back to their own thing, right? Back in their room, and you wonder where their room is. Well, for now, it's still the brick room. The moisture is leaving the floor. Flooring will be happening soon, so we'll finally have our big space as well, but just a little longer. And we will finally be there. So looking forward to fall and all that it brings. As we move into fall, there's something that I feel is important to share with you today, something that we all need to know as a family and as we move together. You know, as you look at church, we say it repeatedly, church isn't a facility. We've built a facility and added onto a facility, and people will call that church. No, that's where the church meets. That's the house the church meets in. Church isn't a program. Church isn't an event. Sunday morning isn't church. If you would look to your left and right, you will see church. Church are the people you sit with. Church, we're church. Church are the people that you do life with. And I think one of the great privileges of our church has been the number of people who have long hauled it here. People have been here a long time. You know, I don't know if you realize it, but July is anniversary month for us. I mean, we just finished 23 years of being part of this church family. And the differences that have been made in the life of my children and myself and my wife could not have and would not have been made the same way if we'd have ducked out 2 years in or 3 years in or whatever. We've been privileged to have long-term relationships, and we love that. And the reality of modern life is not everybody can stick around. Sometimes people have to move. And so today, it breaks my heart to have to say this, but Jason and Dana Aubrey and their kids have moved. They had to move. They moved to Elgin to pursue a coaching job so that Jason will be able to coach Jackson this senior year of football. It moves them about an hour away from us, a little over. In fact, if you've driven up there or lived up there, it's more like 5 hours away in reality. I always laugh when people ask about distance around here. It's like, well, there's distance and then there's driving. So all of this unfolded quite literally in the last several days that he accepted the job. Their house was sold. They rented an apartment up there. And they're beginning life on a new piece of a journey. It is, it's heartbreaking to me because these have been long haulers. We've done a decade of life together. And the worship, especially that Dana, when Dana leads worship, my goodness, I mean, there's something about her voice that is sweet and rich, and it matches the sweetness and richness of her personality. When Jason drums, I didn't think it was possible to worship drumming. I thought you just had fun. I mean, watching this guy drum, God is going to give Jason the privilege someday of sitting in front of him and saying, I'm just going to watch you drum for a minute because I love watching you worship. I love watching you worship. So they're about to begin a new journey. And for us, that, you know, that's going to leave a little bit of an interesting Sunday morning hole because these are people we've come to be used to. I mean, part of family is you go home and you expect your family members to be there. And all of a sudden, these family members we've been used to aren't here. One of the things it does is it opens up possibilities. I think that it's interesting, you know, through the years we've had at least 23 years, we've had at least five different main worship leaders. And every time one of them left, people would look and, oh no, the sky is falling and what are we going to do? And the world is coming to an end. And the next Sunday there would be somebody leading worship. And before you know it, they were leaving and said, oh, they're leaving, the sky is falling, the world is going to come to an end. God always supplies what God wants done in his family. I always kind of laugh that the last Sunday that I was at the church in St. Louis, the very last Sunday was the first Sunday of the guy that not only took over my spot, but ultimately took over as senior pastor. He showed up as a visitor that Sunday. And this, I checked to see, this very morning, he's still the pastor at that church. The irony, too, is his last name was Priest. And Pap in Hungarian means priest. So they went from pastor priest to pastor priest. Kind of fun. God always supplies what we need. And it's not as if we have nobody to lead worship. We still have great worship leaders. But we will miss what Jason and Dana and their family bring to our own. Now, what I asked them to do, because, you know, they're moving into football, your head goes down, you just start to run. And I said, you can't just ghost us. Have you heard of ghosting? I just heard this on the radio. It's fantastic. I was going to save it for a sermon, but I got to use it now. You know, people like just disappear these days. You're texting, all of a sudden they're gone. Boom. You're at Facebook, boom, 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 boom. Where'd they go? Ghosting you. People are ghosting jobs. Though they just, you know, they've been working there 12 years and they just don't show up the next day. You're like, where'd they go? I don't know. Boom, gone. It's like mini raptures. You know, what's going on here? So I didn't use the word because she wouldn't understand it, but I'm like, you're not ghosting us. You don't get to ghost us. So on August 12th, 2 weeks from now, Jason, Dana, Jackson, and Kennedy will be here to help lead us along with our full band in worship. And we'll do a lot of extra music that morning and just kind of fill our tanks with the beauty of that day and have a chance to be able to say a proper so long. Because, I think this is one of the things in the modern era of Christ Church that drives me nuts, that people just ghost away. We're family. We don't ghost each other. At least if we're going to go, we say, I love you. I'll see you at Jewel. You know, something. But, yeah. So, I wanted the chance to share that with you today, and so that you know it from us. Because I know sometimes, you know, a Dana leaves and everybody's like, what happened? Is he teaching heresy again? No. We have a fantastic relationship. Very, very good relationship. But this is the role that they had to take in order to fulfill what they want to and need to for their own family. So I think that is it. We are, you're not allowed to end early when I'm here, when I'm, you know, it makes me look bad when we run like 10 minutes over and here you're ending 5 minutes early. What is this stuff? But it was on the schedule. Let's stand. Father God in heaven, you are and continue to be a good, good father. And you are the father of a wonderful family. I'm grateful that I get to be part of the local family called Southfield. I'm grateful for the people that you have brought into our lives and given us for a season. I know that when Jason and Dana walked into this church, they never dreamed they'd be here a decade later. It's just not the way it works in football world. And you give us a great decade of shared ministry with them. And that doesn't mean that our friendship has to end. But this particular season comes to an end. So we look forward to 2 weeks when we'll gather together again and sing and celebrate the way we will when we're gathered at your feet in heaven. I'm grateful for the opportunity you provided our kids during the month of July to be in with us, to know what happens in the big room, to take communion, to listen to a message, to sing along with mom or dad. I'm thankful for the way that you continue to grow us and open us up to new opportunities. Pray that we would not stop fighting, that we would not stop racing, that we would not stop pressing toward the prize. So run to win. Run to win. Don't lay down. Run to win. I pray that we will hear the voices of the saints of heaven again and again and saying, don't stop. You're almost there. You're almost home. Keep running. Run to win. We love you, Jesus. Amen. We'll see you next week.